I like to do well at the beginning of a new job. Anyone else? Anyone else like to have a good first month, at least? Well, in my first couple of weeks here in January, here at Gainesville Bible Church, I decided that the sign needed to be changed. And so I wanted to change out the lettering on the sign, but I didn't think I could reach the sign. So what I decided to do was drive my truck down there. Don't do that. This is a picture of my truck next to the sign, and I don't know if you can tell, but my tires are going nowhere. I found myself just a few weeks into my brand new job stuck. And I thought to myself, who am I going to call? So I called my buddy Keith over here, and here's the next picture of Keith trying to pull me out of the mud, trying to pull me out of the muck. And I don't know if you can tell, but Keith, as good an effort as you gave, he got stuck too. So we were having a really fun time here, being stuck in the mud, now two trucks stuck in the mud, but fortunately Ronnie came to our rescue and pulled both of us out. In fact, here's a couple more pictures of the events. This is quite exciting pictures. One, if you get stuck in the mud and you're going to get pulled out, guess what? It's going to be real muddy, right? A lot of mud on my truck there. But even more exciting is the picture on the right. By the way, shut your doors when someone's trying to pull you out the mud. I don't know. Things you learn in your 40s, I guess, right? Yeah, this was a really exciting time, and honestly, all of us look back on it. I look back on it and laugh, because surely enough, that's just the way the beginning of my first few weeks here at Gainesville Bible went. But in a lot of ways, in a lot of times, this is where we find our lives, right? Our lives can be stuck in the mud, whether due to a situation or due to our own sin. Sometimes our lives can be stuck in the mud, maybe mentally stuck in the mud, emotionally stuck in the mud, or even physically stuck in the mud, like David found himself sometimes. That's the reason why he wrote this psalm. We're going to be in Psalm 40 today. Psalm 40 is a beautiful prayer and really recognition of David seeing God for who he is, and seeing how God moves him out of the mud, moves him out of the distress, of the many distresses in his life. He saw God's power. He saw God's strength. And this is a psalm that David writes, reflecting back on the many times in which God rescued him and delivered him. So that's why we're going to go through this psalm, and we're going to see four keys to moving forward. Four keys to getting out of the mud that you might be in. This is a beautiful psalm, like I've said, that David writes and reflects on the many times he may have found himself there. And in these four keys is going to be a little hidden gem. It's not really hidden, but a little gem as well about Jesus Christ, and about his sacrifice for us, which perhaps is the greatest key of all that we need to recognize and know. Let's begin. Let's look at the first five verses. The first five verses read this way. I waited patiently for the Lord. He inclined to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the pit of destruction, out of the miry bog. The word bog there is the idea of mud. That's where we get that opening image from. And he set my feet upon a rock, making my steps secure. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in the Lord. Look at verse 4. Blessed is the man. This is some of the outworkings now of being delivered out of this mud. Blessed is the man who makes the Lord his trust, who does not turn to the proud, to those who go astray after a lie. He doesn't turn to others. He turns merely and only to the Lord. You have multiplied, here in verse 5, O Lord, my God, your wondrous deeds and your thoughts toward us. None can compare with you. I will proclaim and tell of them, yet they are more than could be told. Perhaps there's an entire sermon just in these five verses. But just looking at it, we see David stuck in the bog, in the mud. Whatever has gone on in his life, something has got him down. Now, David here isn't actually referring to a time when he was stuck in mud, right? We can read through the story of David, and we don't have a time where he actually was here, because instead he's using words allegorically. It really isn't an allegory referring back to all of the difficulties and the times in which David found himself stuck. And it was either stuck because of his own sin or his own situation. There's a time in David's life when there were those out to actually kill him. Not his fault. It's a situation that he's in. But there were other times where sin put him in the mud. His sin of adultery and murder of somebody else. And yet David is a man after God's own heart. Lots of times I enjoy looking at the story of David because I find myself not in bad company. As I can reflect on the great victories God has brought me through, while at the same time reflecting on the scars that life has brought me. Looking here in verses 1 through 3, we see David then stuck in the mud. In verses 4 and 5, reflect on some of the outworkings of that you are blessed, that the Lord has done wondrous deeds, and that David will now go forward and proclaim. But the biggest key, the biggest takeaway I have for us is how David gets out of the mud and out of the clay is that he waits. He waits by trusting. See, David's not trying to figure out on his own. He's not trying to pull himself up by the bootstraps. He's not trying to try really hard. But instead, he just waits. It's the very first word. I waited. I waited patiently for the Lord. Now, as much as we like talking about getting our trucks stuck in mud, I grew up on a farm with cows and horses and everything. And every evening, my grandfather would feed the cows. And the cows would come running to where the barn is, because they would hear the feed. They would hear everything start shaking. They would hear some commotion in the barn, and they would come running. And my grandfather, Abe Childress, he would then sit there and feed the cows and the horses and make sure he had them all, right? Because he starts counting them. And he's got a name for them all, you know, Betsy, Tommy, I don't know. I didn't know his cows' names. But he counts them all, right? And he goes, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and, you know, and he gets to 12 or 13 and says, wait, I'm missing one. Well, these cows are important to me as a farmer, and so I've got to go find this cow. And typically, normally, the cow got stuck somewhere. The cow is stuck in mud out in the 200 acres that we had. The cow is out there somewhere, stuck in the mud, and I have to go find it. Now, if that cow tries to fight and it tries really hard and tries to, with all of its strength, try to get out of that mud, typically those cows don't, and their situation gets worse. The more they move and the more they would move their legs, they would sink down and they would sink down and they would make their noises and moo and cry for help and cry for help. And you know what that cow has to do? Wait. Has to wait for the farmer to come. And the farmer goes down, gets in the mud, and takes the cow out. Back in the day when things were done a little bit more old school. Get a couple of ropes tied to a truck, but at the same time, he had to get down in that mud with the cow and help the cow out. This is what David does. He doesn't sit there and struggle and make his situation worse. He doesn't continue to commit more sins to make his situation worse. Instead, he waits by trusting. He's going to trust that the Lord is going to come through. Just like old Betsy was sitting there in the mud, waiting on the farmer. I'm trusting that my creator, I'm trusting that my owner, I'm trusting that my God will come. This is the first key to us trusting and getting out of that mud, getting out of that miry clay. going on, looking at verse 6. Verses 6 through 10. Or 6, 7, and 8 for now. It says this. This is the second key for us here when it comes to the text. It says, in sacrifice and offering, you have not delighted, but you have given me an open ear. Burnt offering and sin offering you have not required. Then I said, behold, I have come in the scroll of the book. It is written of me. I delight to do your will, O God. Your law is within my heart. Going on in verse 9 and 10, it says, I have told the glad news of deliverance in the great congregation. Behold, I have not restrained my lips, as you know, O Lord. I have not hidden your deliverance within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your salvation. I have not concealed your steadfast love and your faithfulness from the great congregation. This is a fascinating text because it really upends what we think about the Old Testament. It upends what we think about the Mosaic Law. Look at the text, verse 6. In sacrifice and offerings, and then he goes on to say, in burnt offerings and sin. An offering requires blood. It requires sacrifice. An offering, though, versus a sacrifice, an offering wasn't always one that required blood. There were such things as grain offerings. They were symbolic, then, of what God was doing. David lists all of these out because he is being all-inclusive. He's being all-inclusive of this sacrifice and offering system in the Mosaic Law. And what does he say about it? He says, if we just do this Mosaic Law and all of these offerings really well and we do it right, we'll be okay. It's actually not what he says, is it? He actually says, God, you haven't even required this. What is it that you require? We're going to talk about the heart then. Because it was the heart that was the issue. This was not an elimination of the sacrificial system. No, instead, Jesus ultimately is the fulfillment of that system. There was nothing wrong with that system. There was nothing inherently misplaced or misunderstood, but instead it was us, humanity, that finds its issue when it is placed into our hands. But still, nevertheless, God seems to be not happy with the sacrificial system. But it's not that he's not happy with the system. He's not happy with how we have taken it or how Israel has taken it when you consider the context. And in verses 9 and 10, we'll look at more closely when we go a little more deeper into this text. But David here is in the mud. David here has waited on the Lord to rescue him. And now David says, in summary, the second key is delightful duty. Delightful duty. Delightful obligations. Those two things seem to be contradictory at times, but I think that's the point that David is getting at. David is telling his readers, specifically Israelites at the time, he said, you have had these things. You have had the sacrifices. You have had the offerings, but your heart has been disconnected from it. It's simply just rote routine, and it has no impact or no meaning for you when it comes to your relationship with the Creator. But the whole reason God put this in is so that you would know me more. Is disconnected and it simply has become an obligation. Simply has become something that I'm told to do, and I do what I'm told to do simply because the Bible tells me to do it, but it has no bearing at all on my relationship with God. This is the disconnect and why God says that's not what I have required. I have required a heart that wants to serve me. I have required a heart that is passionate to me, and all the other things are outworkings of that. Interesting enough, this is where we have a citation or a quote really in the New Testament. Hebrews 5:10-12, really 10, 5 through 10, is the quotation, but I wanted to take us a little beyond even the direct quotation. In Hebrews 10, 5 through 12, we see that the author of Hebrews, the whole book of Hebrews, is based on Jesus is better. If you ever wanted a summary of an entire book of the Bible, Jesus is better. Jesus is better than the priest that you had. Jesus is better than the sacrificial system that you had. Jesus is better than the so-called rights that you had within a nation. Jesus is better. And the author of Hebrews uses Psalm 40 as part of his argument to say that Jesus is the greater sacrifice. Let's look at it. How does the author of Hebrews then use this? And therefore, when we go back to Psalm 40, we understand that there is some foreshadowing of Jesus himself. Look at Hebrews 10. Consequently, when Christ came into the world, he said, "Sacrifices and offerings you have not desired, but a body have you prepared for me." Now, that's a little bit change in what is said in the psalm, isn't it? We'll talk about that here in a second. Verse 6, though, this is Jesus speaking, according to the Hebrew author. "In burnt offerings and sin offerings, you have taken no pleasure. Then I said, 'Behold, I have come to do your will, O God, as it is written of me in the scroll of the book.'" Isn't that fascinating? When David is writing this, it is ultimately Jesus into the New Testament that says that was being written about me. Going on, though, look at verse 8. "When he said above," and now this is the author of Hebrews now interpreting the quotation from Psalm 40. "When he said above," when Jesus said this, "you have neither desired nor taken pleasure in sacrifices and offerings and burnt offerings and sin offerings. These are offered according to the law." Then he added, "Behold, I have come to do your will." Put that away. "I have come to do your will." There's the heart. He does away with the first in order to establish the second, the new covenant. Verse 10, "And by that will we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once and for all." Now, like I said, there's some subtle, I wouldn't even call it subtle. It's very different. Look back at verse 5. Verse 5, the author of Hebrews is quoting and attempting to quote from Psalm 40. When Psalm 40 says something a little bit different, doesn't it? Psalm 40 says in verse 6, "But you have given me an open ear." There's a lot of discussion and debate on what this means. One commentator, and quite a few of them, seem to have a pretty good edge on this, and that is, this is referring back to those bond slaves in Israelite time that they loved their master so much that they would lay their ear down on a piece of wood so that their master could could pierce through their ear and put a little loop in their ear that signified, "You belong to this person," right? This was the idea of slavery, but this was voluntary. This was not forced on anyone. This was a voluntary act by a slave or a former slave to say, "Listen, here's my open ear. I belong to you. I'm your servant." So either way, whether it's Psalm 40 saying, "Give me an open ear," or it is here in Hebrews, "But a body have you prepared for me," either way, it's in reference to Jesus saying, "I'm all in," saying, "I'm in for this completely." In fact, Jesus himself would say, "I am serving the Father and doing the Father's will." So I think, in a sense, Hebrews, although it is quoting Psalm 40, he's playing with the meaning of the text at the same time and trying to help us understand the meaning of that text. So the author of Hebrews here teaches us what Jesus does, that he is that sacrifice, that he is the one that will be pleasing to God. And it is because of his actions that he does what we cannot do. So why do I say that this section in getting out of the mud back in Psalm 40 and getting out of the mud, why does this encourage us with delightful duty? Because ultimately what Jesus does is just that. He does his Father's will, no matter what it costs him. But it is with happiness. It is with delight. And what makes it delightful is that you make the Father delighted. Did you catch that? It's not the action in and of itself. Jesus is in a garden, sweating blood the day before, the night before, the morning before he's going to be crucified. And he even says, Father, if you can take this cup from me, if there's any other way, do it. But I'm committed to your will. I'm a bondservant to you. And I find delight in that because you take delight in my obedience. Here's some helpful things for us when it comes to being delightful in our duty and not just simply seeing the things of God as obligations. Number one is this, focus on the heart. Verse 8, focus on the heart. I delight to do your will, O my God. Your law is within my heart. Why does God not take delight in us? Why does God not take delight in the sacrifices? Sorry, I meant to say sacrifices. Why does God not take delight in the things that he said, go do? It is because our hearts are disconnected. It's because our delight is disconnected from the will of God. Make and help us to do the will of God in a delightful way and not simply via obligations. Make sure your heart is in it. Make sure you do as David does and say, I delight to do your will, right? I don't delight to do mine. The problem with the sacrifices of the Old Testament, like I've said, there was just no heart in it. Doing these sacrifices became a thing to do just to accomplish something, not in response to the love of God. So number one, focus on the heart. Number two, tell the good news. Tell of something good. What makes delightful duty? Focusing on the heart and then also telling the news. Look at verse 9. I have told the glad news of deliverance in the great congregation. Behold, I have not restrained my lips, as you know, O Lord. Isn't that interesting? That even in the Psalms, we have this storyline of the good news. Now, I preach out of the ESV. I like that translation, and sometimes other translations have better translations. When this popped up in my study and seeing the word glad news, I thought, okay, gospel? But that's a Greek term, euangelion. That's a New Testament idea, and we find traces of it in the Old Testament, but rarely do we find actual, like, the language of good news or glad news. And so I had to sit there and go and look at the Hebrew and thought to myself, there must be something else going on here. Well, it's actually the term righteousness. The NIV actually gets this better. NIV says, I proclaim righteousness. By the way, that is good news. That is the gospel. The entire book of Romans is predicated on the righteousness of God. And not the righteousness of people. The good news is that we can be righteous in the sight of God through the sacrifice of Christ. So David says, this is such an amazing story. This is such an amazing rescue. I'm going to tell the good news. How could I not? If cows could talk to each other, when my grandfather would go rescue a cow, I guarantee you that cow came back and said, guess what? I didn't die. Guess what? I got some good stuff to tell you. That farmer, he really, really loves us. Because you should have seen him rescue me. You couldn't see him because you're back there eating out of the barn. But if you could have seen the care and compassion that farmer has, you see how that relates to us. That the good news of Christ rescuing us is so big, it is so grand, that David can't help but proclaim it. proclaim his righteousness. You want to get out of, you want to see delightful duty in your life and not mere obligation? Tell the good news. Tell the good news of Jesus Christ. Thirdly is this, don't hide your faith, right? Don't hide your faith. We saw it there in verse 10. David says, I have not hidden your deliverance within my heart. Isn't that interesting? We talk about it all the time of Jesus being in my heart. And we talk about a personal relationship with Jesus. And I think what we have done sometimes is what David is saying he is making sure he doesn't do, and that is to hide it so deeply within myself that nobody sees it. We want a personal relationship with Jesus, and then the next thing we want is a private relationship with Jesus because we don't want anyone knowing about it. We want to keep it to ourselves. This is not what David does. He doesn't hide this for himself. Instead, he speaks of his faithfulness. He speaks of your salvation. He doesn't speak of the things that he can do in and of his home. He doesn't censor this faith. What a beautiful story. What a beautiful truth that we have. And if you want to turn your duty and your obligation that you know has been disconnected, then take these three steps of delightful duty. Focus on the heart, tell the good news, and don't hide your faith. Timothy Keller puts it this way, let yourself be moved by what he did for you until your duty becomes joy. Be moved by what God does for you, not simply know what God has done for you. Going on in verse 11. This next section, verse 11 through 15, demonstrate a third key for us this morning, and that is this. It says, as for you, O Lord, you will not restrain your mercy from me. Your steadfast love and your faithfulness will ever preserve me. For evils have encompassed me beyond number. My iniquities have overtaken me, and I cannot see. They are more than the hairs of my head or on my head. My heart fails me. Verse 13, be pleased, O Lord, to deliver me. O Lord, make haste to help me. Let those be put to shame and disappointed altogether who seek to snatch away my life. Let those be turned back and brought to dishonor who delight in my hurt. Let those be appalled because of their shame who say to me, aha, aha. Very interesting in the last point, if you've ever been persecuted or oppressed because of your faith, this resonates very well because you pray that the Lord will bring you through and bring you through successfully. And those that say, ha, 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 do not have the last word. This is a large section, so I want to go through these key points very quickly. What David is doing here is praying. Key number three is prayer. This may seem like a simple, cliche answer, but the reality is it is very, very important. It is very, very important to David as he prays about all of these things in his life. How can we improve our prayer? Recognize God's perseverance. Recognize God's perseverance. Not our perseverance, but his perseverance. Look back at verse 11. As for you, O Lord, you will not restrain your mercy from me. Your steadfast love and your faithfulness will ever preserve me. Whose steadfast love? Mine for the Lord? I hope my relationship isn't built on that. No, it's because of his love for me. It's not because of my faithfulness to God. It's because of his faithfulness to me. Recognize it is God who passionately pursues you. It is all about him and his faithfulness and his love. Prayer. Recognize God's perseverance. The second point, pray about the situations. Pray about the situations. Again, this psalm, I think David is reflecting back on a lot that has happened in his life. It's no one point or one thing that he's reflecting back on. That's why he can talk about both his situations and his sins. Number one, the situations in verse 12, evils have encompassed me beyond number. David's like, I can't even count them. Now, the evils that have encompassed him, He didn't do anything. He didn't sin. That's why these are situations in his life. He says, my iniquities have overtaken me and I cannot see. He has no guidance in his life. And we'll talk about iniquities here in just a second. So at that first part, for evils have encompassed me beyond number. In your bulletin today, I put in there a prayer request for a certain friend of mine. Pray for the Gray family. The Gray family is, like I said, dear friends of mine. They actually live up in Indiana where we moved from. And their five-year-old son just came down with seizures last week. And then he just passed away a couple of days ago. That's a situation, guys. They're in the mud. They're in a hard time in their life. But they're glorifying God through it all. Pray about the situations in your life. Sometimes we think they're too small or insignificant. There is no insignificant situation. God cares about all of them, whether they're big or whether they're small or whether they're in between. God is relentlessly pursuing you, and he cares about those situations. So pray for them. God recognizes perseverance. In prayer, recognize God's perseverance. In prayer, pray about the situations. Thirdly, confess sin. We see David address this here in verse 12. He says, my iniquities have overtaken me. Now, I'm sure we can think about adultery and murder that happened in David's life, and I bet it felt this way for him. My iniquities have overtaken me, and I cannot see. His sin has crept into his life to such an extent. Remember, he's reflecting on his story. He's reflecting on his past, and he has dug himself into such a deep pit of mud and sin that I cannot see guidance. I cannot see where to go. I cannot find wisdom. And I think for David, it took someone named Nathan to come and pull him on out. Sin is a real thing. Let's never take sin lightly. Sin is our dysfunctionality. Sin is our problem. Sin is our disobedience to our Creator, to the one who cares for us, for the one who loves us. So confess sin, because sin will put you in the mud. Fourthly is this, admit sin's impact. I think this is a small but important point within this sin discussion. Do you see what sin does in the life of David? He cannot see. There are more than the hairs on his head. And then his heart fails him. How many people do you know in today's culture and society who have no heart? Their heart has failed them. Their passions have failed them. Because they're in the mud. Whether Christian or unchristian, they are in the mud and they are drowning. They are stuck. So pray, but admit the reality of sin. Admit that sin is a big deal and a big problem. But you know what's a bigger deal than sin? God's grace. Make sure in our Christian walk, we don't glorify sin to such an extent that we lose sight of his grace and mercy. Because as soon as sin crops up in our life, then you pronounce and you proclaim and you shout the righteousness of God, of how great his grace is and how great his mercy is and how much he loves us. But admit sin's impact at the same time. Never take it lightly. Fourthly is ask for prayer. Ask for prayer. If we look in verses 13, 14, and 15, we see God asking for prayer, especially when he says, let those, we see it actually three times, let those be put to shame. Let those be appalled. He's talking about the others that were against him in his life. And David could have set back and just thought to himself, I'll get myself through this. I will just tough it out. But no, he goes to God and says, God, please intervene. God, do something in my life. When we're stuck in the mud and stuck in the I always call it the miry clay. I think that's from a hymn. Look to prayer. Look to his perseverance and pray about those situations. Confess sin. Admit the impact that sin has and ask for help. Let's finish out this psalm. Looking at verse 16 and 17. This is where we'll find the fourth key that this psalmist gives us, that David helps us to see. Look at the verse 16 and 17. But may all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who love your salvation say continually, great is the Lord. As for me, I am poor and needy, but the Lord takes thought for me. You are my help and my deliverer. Do not delay, oh my God. The fourth key is this: praise with perception. Praise with perception. When I look back at this last two verses, what is it that David says over and over? Rejoice. Rejoice. Bring praise to the Lord. Look what he says of the Lord. He says, who is the Lord? He is great. In fact, all those who love his salvation, all those who love that, and that you have taken me out of the mud, the muck that I was stuck in, I love you and I love that salvation. You are great. Even in the hardest times, even in the times in which I think I don't understand anything that is happening, I will continue to say you are great. Now, I say with perception, because there's one little line here that I think is really important. It's the beginning of verse 17. He says, as for me, I am poor and needy. I am poor and needy. Isn't that interesting? With the proper perception of who we are, with the proper understanding of salvation and the study of soteriology, and with a proper understanding of hermeneutology and sin in our lives, and then knowing who we are in our humanity, knowing that story and understanding how it works, only then can we say, I praise the Lord, because I know the perception of who I am. And in today's culture, go up to just about anyone. Are you a good person? And 90% of people respond, yeah, I'm a good person. You know why here's what they'll say. You know why I'm a good person? I'm going to argue the other side. You know why I'm a good person? Because I do more good things than bad things. Right? So perception is this, right? It's a scales. But that's not grace. And that's not karma. That is karma, actually. But that is not grace. That is not the story that we have. That's not what the psalm here says. Psalm 40, David says, I am perfectly happy and perfectly praising the salvation that you have for me. Why, though? It's not because I'm good. It's not because my good deeds are outweighing my bad deeds. It is because I am poor and needy. I have nothing. And it's when we have that perception of really the depth of his grace, then we begin to see, wait a minute, I've got to praise you. I think my friends, the Gray family, are there now. And they can do nothing but praise because I am poor and needy. You want to get out of the mud of life? You want to get out of the depths that you're in. It's a process. It doesn't happen over time. But I think Psalm 40 here in David gives us a very clear picture of how God has taken David out of his mud and out of his pit multiple times, and seeing these four keys that we need to wait for the Lord's deliverance, that we need to understand that what the Lord wants us to do is not simply obligations, like reading our Bibles and praying and going to church and doing it disconnected from the story of deliverance. Instead, we can find delight in the duty and the obligations and never give up on prayer. And ultimately, praise with perception. We will praise God because he is all that we have.